From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Ramadan Mubarak to all of our Muslim listeners who have begun the observance of a holy month-long fast. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com.
They have struck down the portion of DOMO.
The U.S. Supreme Court today took the teeth out of a law enacted nearly 50 years ago.
In late June, the U.S. Supreme Court delivered a decidedly mixed message on civil rights. Even as Prop 8 and DOMA were defanged, so too was the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And even as immediate steps were taken to resume same-gender weddings in California, several states wasted no time in moving ahead with changes to voting rules that would previously have been challenged under the VRA. So, how do we reconcile this good news, bad news moment with the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s paraphrase of Emma Lazarus, "No one is free until we're all free"? A compelling meditation on this subject, co-written by the Reverend Meg Riley and the Reverend Rosemary Bray McNatt. The headline reads, "Justice is Justice," and both authors will be with us to explore this idea later on this week's show.
A New Testament comes out of my experience talking to a wide range of people about the new discoveries of early Christian documents that basically no one knows about.
After gathering some of the leading scholars on ancient Christian texts, Dr. Hal Taussig of Union Theological Seminary in New York set about examining texts that were left out of the New Testament. The result of this multi-year project has now been published as a New Testament, a Bible for the 21st century, combining traditional and newly discovered texts. And Dr. Taussig will be with us on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
the Egyptian army had opened fire on protesters just before dawn. The Egyptian military claims it came under attack first as protesters tried to storm the Republican Guard.
It is with deep concern and growing sadness that many of us have watched the upheaval in Egypt over the past several weeks. The role of aggressor and victim have shifted back and forth as a democratically elected leader disappointed so many that by some accounts, more Egyptians than had cast a ballot in the first place took to the streets in a very public grassroots recall vote. This kind of turmoil is notoriously difficult to understand, but we've got to try to make some sense of it, and we're fortunate that a well-respected and knowledgeable commentator on the region was in our studios this week. Reza Aslan's new book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus Nazareth, comes out on Tuesday, and I look forward to sharing our conversation about that book on next week's program. This week, however, we took advantage of his expertise to gain some insight into the rapidly changing situation in Egypt. Dr. Aslan, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
How did democratically elected President Mohamed Morsi go so quickly from leader to pariah?
Frankly, what he displayed in his little more than a year as president of Egypt was a shocking incompetence and cronyism. Now, that said, I mean, if incompetence and cronyism was an excuse for a military coup, that we would have had a number of coups ourselves in the United States. But I think in the end, there was just this lack of confidence in his ability to lead, a real mistrust by both the secularists and liberals in Egypt, but also the former remnants of the Mubarak regime, and on the other side of the equation, the more radical Salafists, the so-called Al-Nur party, who believed that the Muslim Brotherhood and President Morsi in particular were not, let's just say, Muslim enough for their taste. So he was really being attacked from all sides at a time in which the Egyptian economy was on the verge of collapse, in which Security had completely broken down. It's hard to say that he ever really had a chance to succeed, but that nevertheless makes the military coup that we've seen over this past week, that doesn't make it any less legitimate or justified, in my view at least.
There are, it seems, two distinct narratives regarding the bloody violence last Monday. Do you agree with those who see that as a game-changing moment in Egypt?
Well, you're right, first of all, that there are two distinct narratives. One narrative is that of independent eyewitnesses and journalists who say that at the beginning of dawn prayers, the army opened fire and ended up killing some 50 members of the Muslim Brotherhood, the pro-Morsi crowd that was there in front of the Republican Guard office for a sit-in. The other narrative comes from the military, which says that they were fired upon first. And again, you can choose to believe whomever you want to believe, but we must at the very least take the military line with a grain of salt. But to your question, you are absolutely right. I think that was a game changer. You have to recall that, you know, a little more than a couple of years ago, the Muslim Brotherhood were an outlawed organization. Simply being a member of the Brotherhood was enough to get you thrown in jail for the rest of your life. There was a very bloody suppression of Brotherhood activities during the military rule of Hosni Mubarak. And it seems as though with this massacre, with the dozens and dozens of Muslim Brotherhood politicians and leaders and activists who have been arrested, that we might very well be heading down that same path again, which I think would be disastrous, not just for Egypt, but for the region as a whole.
Yeah. Reza, you've written in the past that inclusion of moderate Islamists in government tends to weaken support for extremists. Talk about the Muslim Brotherhood from that perspective. Would you consider the Brotherhood as moderate? And if so, what does their ouster from power portend for extremist factions going forward?
The Muslim Brotherhood are religious conservatives, but of course, as we know here in the United States, religious conservatism by no means delegitimizes you from running for office. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do not share their religious beliefs. Many Egyptians do not share their religious beliefs, but that is no excuse in a free and fair democracy for forbidding someone from holding higher office if they can get the electorate to agree with their political views. Mm-hmm. The argument that I was making before is that, you know, for more than a decade, we have been telling these groups around the Middle East that if they put down their guns and pick up ballots instead, that if they renounce violence and take part in political participation, that we will give them an opportunity to join the marketplace of ideas, to allow their beliefs, their ideology to be put to a vote by their populations. And should they be able to win free and fair elections, we will give them an opportunity to, at the very least, fail at being a legitimate political entity. Mm-hmm. Now, the argument that I was making is that nearly in every case in which that has happened, whether we're talking about the Justice and Development Party in Morocco or the AKP in Turkey or the Islamist parties in Indonesia or in Senegal, even in Pakistan, whenever we have allowed these groups to take part in political participation, they have had a profoundly moderating effect on the groups. After all, if you want to stay in power, you need to focus on keeping the lights on and cleaning the streets, and ideology tends to kind of go into the background. And if you focus on ideology to the detriment of the political promises that you've made the electorate, then they will vote you out. In the case of the Muslim Brotherhood, the oldest Islamist organization in the Middle East, an organization that has been at odds with radical groups like Al-Qaeda, which for years has said that democracy is a sham, that political participation is a ruse, that even if you are allowed to run for office, the quote-unquote West, the Zionists and the Crusaders will never allow you to actually finish a term. Well, whatever you want to say about what just happened in Egypt, it has been a tremendous boost to the Al-Qaeda propaganda that political participation is just simply a ruse. And I think that's what is the real tragedy of what just happened. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood right. played by the rules, and it turns out that the rules were just simply changed.
How optimistic are you that there will be a reasonably swift resolution to this? And I guess how much you do or do not trust the military to do what it needs to do.
This is an organization that spent 50 years enjoying absolute power in Egypt and has spent 1 year out of power, and now it's back in power. So anyone who tells you that the Egyptian military has no thirst for remaining in control of Egypt, that it will create a swift exit and allow for a truly free and fair elections again, which, by the way, if there were a truly free and fair elections again, the Muslim Brotherhood would again win those elections, I think is living in some sort of fantasy world. There was a very important article that came out this week in the New York Times that showed that what seemed on the surface to be a spontaneous eruption of anti-Muslim Brotherhood, anti-Morsi demonstrations on the streets of Egypt was in fact well-funded and organized by members of Mubarak's regime, including a number of billionaire cronies of Hosni Mubarak, who quite proudly now are coming out of the shadows and saying that they were the ones who funded this opposition. I don't think that it should come as a surprise to anyone that all of a sudden this endemic energy crisis that had made life so miserable for Egyptians over the last year, in the span of 24 hours, has been fixed. Everybody has lights all of a sudden. Everybody has energy and gas all of a sudden. The police, who were conspicuously absent on the streets over the last year of President Morsi's reign, in which we had a security situation in Egypt that was appalling, murders, thefts, sexual assault, all of a sudden, all the police are back on the streets. As the New York Times said quite clearly, this is not a coincidence. It seems to suggest that there was a well-concerted effort by the military, by Mubarak cronies, aligned with these liberals and secularists, whether these liberal and secularist opposition groups knew it or not, and it seems as though they probably did not know it, to create a sense of crisis that would ultimately result in the toppling of Morsi and the return of the military to power, the return at the very least of Mubarak cronies to power. And frankly, that's exactly what we are seeing now. The interim president of Egypt is a Mubarak crony. So I would love to say that I feel optimistic about what's happening now, but to be perfectly honest, I would not be shocked if we're having the same conversation a year from now and Tahrir Square has another 14 million people demanding yet again an end to military rule.
Reza Eslan is an Iranian-American writer and scholar of religions. His best-selling books include No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. His brand new book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth, comes out on Tuesday, and you'll be able to hear more about it on next week's State of Belief. Thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Still to come on this week's show, Reverend Rosemary Bray McNatt and the Reverend Meg Riley, who've written movingly about the necessity to take on one another's struggle for justice. Dr. Hal Tausig is visiting professor of New Testament at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. He's a specialist in ancient Christian texts and a prolific author on the origins of early religious writing. With the publication of a new New Testament, a Bible for the 21st century combining traditional and newly discovered texts, Dr. Tausig presents a meticulously researched challenge to the black and white thinking regarding Holy Scripture that, frankly, some will find offensive and many of us will find profoundly insightful and helpful. I'm so pleased to welcome Hal Tausig to State of Belief Radio. Welcome, Hal.
Thank you very much, Walton.
What made you do this?
Really, for the past 20 years, I have been in the position of professor at Union in New Testament and as a local pastor and as someone who speaks around the country to large academic and church audiences. I've been having a recurring experience, and that is when I tell people about some of the recently discovered documents from earliest Christianity that are not in the traditional New Testament, I almost every time from all kinds of people have the same response. How come I don't know about these texts as they hear about them and are moved by them? Secondly, they want to say, it feels like I've discovered my long-lost sister or brother when I hear these texts. And thirdly, they keep saying, why isn't this in my New Testament? And after about 10 years of hearing people across the country giving these same responses that I said, it seems like it's important for the larger American public to have a New Testament which includes some of these new discovered documents as well as the traditional texts.
Yeah.
So that's why I wrote it. I wrote it because I felt like every time I turned around, people were asking me to write it.
Sure. There are going to be some people who say, are you saying that the New Testament that you have published has the same kind of authority and sense of sanctity that we've always described when speaking of the New Testament that we have in our Bibles just after the Old Testament?
I would say a similar authority, but not quite the same. It's important to note that I've called this a new Testament, not the new Testament. That is, in the book itself, alongside of all of these texts that we've put together, both traditional and new, I say, I hope that in the next 50 years, some other people also put together other new Testaments. As I know how the traditional New Testament came into being, it took 500 years for the church to understand what content should be in the traditional New Testament. So it seems presumptuous of me to say that 2 years would settle everything, as I want to place myself with some humility in the larger context of the church and how it makes decisions. Many of us don't know that it took 500 years for churches to be clear on the first take. And so I want to say, yes, please look to this new Testament for similar authority, for similar spiritual growth. But I'm not ready to say that, for instance, the Council of National Spiritual Leaders that put this together, that we made all of the right choices.
I think there are some people who don't realize that the New Testament came into a being over five centuries. How did the New Testament come into being?
No one was asking even the question of what should be the authoritative teachings for at least 100 years. To even say, I wonder if there are some of the hundreds of writings about Jesus, should we distinguish between some and the other? And then for another century or two, there were people who were saying, I like this set of books better than this set of books, and we're not sure about some of the others. For instance, when Constantine, the emperor who converted to Christianity, when he asked his secretary, Eusebius, what are the authoritative writings, Eusebius made a report and said, well, some are considered correct, some are considered under debate, and some are considered spurious. Then it took another 150 years under the emperor's urging for people to try to come up with what was authoritative, and then probably at least another 100 years for people to begin to say, yes, I think we've got this right. No church council ever asked the question for the first 500 years. A couple of regional ones did.
Hmm. So who made the final decision about who got in the New Testament and who didn't?
We really don't know. The first church council that made a decision about what the content of the traditional New Testament was the Council of Trent in the 16th century. That's way further along. It is true that the person who translated many of the important documents of early Christianity into Latin, Jerome, in the 5th century, made a choice of which documents he was going to choose to translate into Latin, which, of course, in that case, was the main people's language. So Jerome made some decisions in contact with the popes, but there was no formal decision.
Yeah. And is it not true that to this very moment, different religious denominations within Christianity have differing positions on what constitutes the New Testament?
Well, yes. The Syriac tradition, the Ethiopian tradition are different than what we would call the Western tradition. So the Church Universal, as we might call it around the world, has actually never agreed on what is in the New Testament officially.
Dr. Taussig, I think one of the most exciting things about the New Testament that you have helped provide is the inclusion of female voices within the Christian tradition. Would you talk a little bit about the significance of those voices from a historic perspective?
The Gospel of Mary Magdalene, for instance, was only discovered in the late 19th century and only came into translation in the middle of the 20th century and isn't known, but it is the only gospel we have where the main character is a woman in the voice of Mary Magdalene. Similarly, a text that actually we've had around for a long time that's been very popular throughout the church's history, the Acts of Paul and Thecla, has the main character as a young teenage woman who decides to follow Paul and gets punished radically for it, but insists so much. And even though Paul is kind of lukewarm to her coming, he doesn't reject her. And finally, she baptizes herself and takes on the message of Paul and spends her life teaching the messages of Paul. For us to be able to have that kind of story in our New Testament means so much to the possibility of mutuality of learning between men and women.
What's new here? What helps us better understand the existing books of the New Testament? And what broadening of vision is there in what you've discovered about the nature and ministry of Jesus?
When I ask these bishops and heads of denominations and internationally known scholars to be a part of this council, I did not give them any criteria to judge. I said, please use your best wisdom for this, and please use what you know to decide on. I don't insist on a common criterion. What emerged were very drastically new things that happened in these new documents. So, for instance, we talked about the increased presence of women's authority and voice. But in addition, the council chose three sets of prayers. The traditional New Testament doesn't actually have very many prayers, but we have a boatload of prayers that were composed in the spirit of Jesus in the first 100 years or so, like the Odes of Solomon, which are at least 41 really important psalms that are basically psalms written in the voice of Christ or with the consciousness of the ministry of Jesus. We have also a prayer of thanksgiving, which is a prayer of the gathered Christians at meals. We now know much more about the spiritual life of the early followers of Jesus.
Is there anything in these new materials for most people that has some very large impact on theological doctrine?
We do have a broadening of the view of Jesus. So, for instance, we look at the Gospel of Thomas. The Gospel of Thomas is a relatively newly discovered way of thinking about Jesus, in which the Gospel of Thomas contains only the teachings of Jesus. Nothing happens in the Gospel of Thomas. About half of those teachings are ones that are in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The others are completely new. Similarly, I would say the Gospel of Truth has a wonderful new set of images of Jesus on the cross and what the death of Jesus means. There are subject matters that are deepened and thought of differently, often in complementary ways, often in somewhat new ways that we don't have in the existing Gospels.
What did this project do to you personally in terms of your own spiritual life?
Thank you so much. It's so important that we who are in ministry and in academics really keep in touch with our own process spiritually. For me, it was a gentle opening to a set of rich material that connected to me in my heart that I simply didn't know before, and that that occasionally made me see the traditional material differently, but mostly just made what I had initially seen in traditional works, made it deepen and broaden. For me, it was a gradual and gracious process of seeing my world and, I would say, my relationship to God broaden and deepen.
Dr. Hal Taussig is visiting professor of New Testament at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. After extensive research and deliberations with a distinguished panel of fellow scholars, he has published A New Testament, a Bible for the 21st Century, combining traditional and newly discovered texts. I think this is a really exciting piece of work. I can't imagine why anyone interested in better understanding the biblical world and the context in which faith was born and shaped would not appreciate greatly what you've done. And so I congratulate you on completing what had to be a massive research and curating project. And I thank you for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It's a great privilege, and I appreciate your interest as well.
On June 25th, the United States Supreme Court struck down a key provision of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, in practical terms, invalidating federal oversight of voter disenfranchisement efforts across the country. In the hours that followed, it was hard to see as anything other than cynical the immediate actions in numerous jurisdictions to implement voting rules that would previously have been challenged on constitutional grounds. The following day, the court handed down decisions that had the effect of lifting restrictions on same-gender marriage in California and neutering the anti-gay rights most powerful weapon, the so-called Defense of Marriage Act. Joining me now are two Unitarian Universalist pastors who recently co-wrote a powerful commentary on just this question. It's headlined, Justice is Justice, and we're going to link to it from stateofbelief.com so you can read it for yourself. Meg, Rosemary, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
It's so good to be with you.
It's exciting that yours is more than a call for unity in the struggle for justice. It is, in fact, a demonstration of that unity. Rosemary, you're an African-American pastor working in New York City with its profound economic and social inequalities. Meg, you're a lesbian pastor with a long history of fighting for marriage equality in Minnesota and nationally. What moved you to collaborate on this piece?
Mr. Rosemary, I think I wanted to reach out because I was mumbling to myself in the house the whole week all this was going on. And whenever I start talking to myself about stuff, it means I need to be writing about it. And I didn't want to just write a piece that said, oh, you know, this is really making me angry. Oh, we need to come together around these things. I wanted to do what I try to do in my life and in my ministry, which is to partner with people around common issues. And Meg and I have worked together on other things throughout the years. And I knew that Meg was active in marriage equality movements in Minnesota the way I've been active in them in New York. And so I felt like it was a good way for us to kind of speak and exemplify what we are after.
Meg, what about you?
Well, you know, to have such a victory on something so close to me as marriage equality come down so significantly close chronologically to such a horrible decision by the Supreme Court. So when Rose called me, I just was thrilled to be able to also take some action, because it's so easy to just feel tied up in knots and rageful and helpless and all of those things that are so unpleasant.
The article that you wrote is headlined, Justice is Justice. And I want to ask each of you, if you will, to briefly define what that word justice means in your ministry and in your life.
Justice is not just us. And whenever you're thinking just us, you're not thinking about justice. Rose, I'll let you go.
I really do try to come at it as a pastor. For me, it is about the fullness of life and about the
inherent worth and dignity that all of us really are born with, and the capacity to live that out in the world. And anything that blocks that capacity deserves our attention, our focus, our energy to move those obstacles aside. And I really believe that the time has come for people to stop being in silos around which particular issue is the more important issue, because what we know and what we can see is that the people who oppose justice are people who are working against a wide variety of people who they do not believe deserve that fullness of life. It is up to us to twist that narrative and to work together in ways that our opponents don't necessarily expect.
Well said. There certainly have been some African-American pastors and congregations who have actively worked against campaigns for LGBT equality. Rosemary, where should LGBT people look to find allies in the African-American community?
I think they should actually look everywhere. Just because a pastor is speaking from a pulpit and saying things that are hateful or homophobic doesn't mean that everybody in the congregation feels the same way. And people who are in the African-American church community are not monolithic. And I think that we may be oversold by the media, the idea that there is opposition in the African-American community. All gay people are not white. There are the same number of gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender African-Americans in our communities that there are in other communities. And some of those people are in church. So we should not assume that there is not support. There's also some affirming churches, very specifically affirming African-American churches that are very upfront about their support of marriage equality and a full range of rights and privileges for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people.
A number of national and local LGBT groups spoke out immediately against the Supreme Court's ruling on the Voting Rights Act, but the perception has been that, for the most part, their focus has been on celebrating victories in the LGBT community. That's understandable, of course, but Meg, what should the LGBT community do now to demonstrate its solidarity with other minority groups?
Facilitate the leadership of the non-white GLBT leaders who have been working hard for years to say this is not two separate communities, and really lift them up. Too much of the marriage equality struggle, I think, has been framed as white upper middle class, you know, couples because it's unthreatening. But, you know, groups like the National Black Justice Coalition and Many Voices have been working for years to lift up other kinds of leadership. And so one thing is to support that. I think a really concrete thing coming up is the centennial on the March on Washington, of which Bayard Rustin, who was one of those many people who's both black and gay, was an absolute architect of that march, takes that opportunity to lift up the unity of the communities and the, you know, 50-year history here. Also, I think for me, it means, you know, I got called recently by somebody saying, you know, now that you have marriage equality in Minnesota, will you help organize Minnesotans to stand up for marriage equality in other states? And I said, you know, that's great you're doing that, and I can give you some names, but really that's not where my energy is going right now. I feel like I put a lot into marriage equality, and I'm really glad other people are, and I really want to put my organizing energy, of which we all have a limited amount when we're ministers, I want to put that into the voting rights, because that's going to be coming up everywhere. And, you know, it's going to require some creative coalition building and some hard work, frankly. It's going to be pretty hard work.
The Reverend Meg Riley is senior minister of the Church of the Larger Fellowship, a Unitarian congregation without walls. The Reverend Rosemary Bray McNatt is senior minister of the Fourth Universalist Society in New York City. Together, these two authored a powerful call for a recommitment to shared struggle titled Justice is Justice. Thanks to both of you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having us. Well,
thank you for all your work.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com, and please consider making a contribution today to help us do what we do best. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line 800-856-0277. As always, we encourage you to tell others about this show and encourage them to listen. We'd love to have them as a part of the conversation and love for them to be able to join you in conversations about this show. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. We'll take an in-depth look at Reza Aslan's new book, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Also, the Family Research Council and its allies have declared July to be ex-gay Pride Month. We'll expose what they're really celebrating with some true stories from various survivors of the so-called ex-gay movement. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.